and welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Dalberto Hodge, and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I'm joined by my friends
Giselle Donnelly. I also work at AEI, along with
Yulia Zsozsa with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington University.
On our podcast, we talk about the challenges to European peace and security that have erupted along a line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why those matter to the United States. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Our special guest today is Artur Kacprzyk, an analyst with the Polish Institute for International Affairs, which is a Polish think tank based in Warsaw, but which has recently opened an office in Washington and that puts out research both in Polish and in English, and that is seeking to engage with an American audience as well. So I would very much encourage people to look up their work and their events and see the sort of treasure trove of research that they have already published on questions of Polish and Central European security. Arthur, you work on nuclear-related issues, and you've recently put out a report that looks at NATO's own nuclear posture in Europe. But perhaps to kick off this conversation, I would like to take a sort of step back and to look at the ongoing Ukraine situation and point out that perhaps one of the reasons for why in the middle of this war is that in the 1990s, Ukraine was pressured by a range of international actors, including Western powers, to give up its own nuclear arsenal. And it did so with the expectation that it would be safe and that its territorial integrity would be guaranteed going forward. And so I would argue that a lot might hinge on the outcome of this war for the prospect of future nuclear proliferation. And indeed, you know, the thinking of actors in Eastern Europe might be affected by the outcome of this war with regard to their own nuclear arsenals and moves in this space. Am I completely misguided in being concerned about the prospect of future nuclear proliferation? You know, Ukraine is defeated, absorbed, decapitated by Russia.
Okay, so hello. First and foremost, thank you very much for the invitation to the podcast. It's a real pleasure. Starting right up with your first question as regards nuclear proliferation. When it comes to Ukraine and Ukraine, you know, transferring the post-Soviet nukes to Russia and then being invaded by Russia in violation of Russia's commitment not to do so from the 1994 Budapest Memorandum and a number of other, you know, agreements and commitments, I would say this is probably less of a question about what would happen if Ukraine kept nukes, because, you know, there were many challenges for Ukraine to keep this arsenal. First of all, it was controlled by Russia when it comes, you know, with codes needed to launch those weapons and so on. And Ukraine itself was in a very poor economic situation. So there are indeed questions whether they would be able to upkeep those weapons. But that's not the most important part. The most important part is, did Ukraine get enough support from the US, from other Western countries, after it gave up those nuclear weapons? Did Ukraine get enough support faced with Russian aggression? And clearly it did not for many years after 2014. It is getting a lot of support right now, but still, I would say the ball is still in play. If Russia manages to win this war, or at least not lose it, and they might have their own definitions what, you know, victory or being defeated and not defeated means in this war, it would have, I think, first of all, grave consequences for our NATO's nuclear deterrence, about which we will talk later. But I would agree with you, this would pose also nuclear proliferation risks. Actually, that's the thing that the Polish current foreign minister Radosław Sikorski said publicly. He later said that he meant, first of all, East Asian countries, so South Korea and Japan probably, you know, a non-nuclear country being attacked by a nuclear power with the help of nuclear threats aimed at, you know, other countries to make them not support Ukraine, right? So the attacked non-nuclear country. I think this would incite deliberations, conversations about nuclear proliferation in many parts of the world, I would say. And the other factor, of course, which could do so would be if US cut down its own commitment to NATO after the upcoming presidential elections, meaning, you know, withdrawing from NATO or cutting down its presence. So to put it shortly, yes, there are definitely proliferation risks, I would say, related to this war and security situation in general.
So let's turn to the report that you did and to NATO itself. So NATO countries, United States, UK, France, have nukes. And you argue in the report that the deterrent that exists is an effective one. But given Russia's behavior, Western powers that have nuclear weapons and NATO as a collective body have to think about how they work with this deterrent, both in terms of how they communicate, but also in terms of what capabilities they have and where they sort of decide to place those capabilities. So could you sort of walk us through the sort of main recommendations that you arrive at with your analysis?
Sure. The main recommendation is that in NATO, we need to do more as regards, you know, strengthening our nuclear deterrent than NATO is doing or is planning to do right now. And I also argue that the quickest way to do that would be to enlarge the participation of NATO countries in nuclear sharing. So a kind of concept which assumes that US deploys its nuclear weapons in certain countries under US control, which could be used, if US allows that, by allied aircraft in wartime. And I argue that at least one Eastern Flank country, such as Poland, should be in this program, because right now no country would join NATO after the Cold War is hosting US nuclear weapons or providing aircraft for their delivery. And I'm putting some emphasis here on what we can do relatively quickly, meaning in the coming years, because I see a number of risk factors that could challenge our NATO's deterrent, that would increase the risk of Russian aggression against NATO under a nuclear umbrella. So my starting point is that we should appreciate that this nuclear deterrent is working right now, right? Russia is not attacking us. Russia is not using nuclear weapons at all. But on the other hand, as I mentioned in response to your previous question, it's still an open matter what lessons about their nuclear intimidation they are going to draw from this ongoing war, right? On the one hand, Ukraine received lots of ammunition, support, equipment from the West. On the other hand, so in large part, this intimidation by Russians, these various signals that this war could escalate to a nuclear one, was not successful. On the other hand, it has been successful to some extent. I mean, you know, Germany is not sending Taurus long-range cruise missiles to Ukraine out of fear of nuclear escalation. Chancellor Scholz said it publicly and openly. US is not also sending its longer range of ATACMS missile to Ukraine for the same reason. The weapons given to Ukraine from all, if not most, Western countries are given under the condition that they should not be used against targets on Russian territory. Now the US is even discouraging some attacks by Ukraine with their own, you know, indigenous equipment against Russia. Russian raffineries, to be exact. And, you know, some leaders like President Biden, Chancellor Scholz, especially at the beginning of the war, are saying that, well, we're not sending soldiers to Ukraine because it would start the World War III. So I think from the Russian perspective, if they win this war, they can give some credit to their nuclear intimidation, as well as the fact that, yes, we've given a lot of arms to Ukraine, but Russian nuclear threats have delayed, you know, the provision of subsequent types of this equipment, right? The Patriot missiles, tanks, and other stuff, which helped Russia, actually, these delays helped Russia to prepare and wage war. So Russia and Ukraine is I think, the central point here in my argumentation. How this war ends will have an impact on Russian perception of our result. There are also other matters, so let me just flag them here and maybe discuss them in more detail later, because some of them are military technical in their nature. I mean, there's also, of course, the issue of the growing risk of war in Indo-Pacific between China and US. And again, if US is drawn into war in Indo-Pacific, this means, first of all, that, you know, Russians might think that US would not be willing to risk nuclear war in two theaters at the same time, that the US would be focused on fighting China, which is its main competitor right now. On the other hand, some of the assets, US long-range assets, like strategic bombers especially, which would be useful in responding to a Russian limited nuclear strike in Europe, could, in such situation of two-front war, be engaged in operations in Indo-Pacific, conventional ones. Maybe nuclear ones as well. So this is the, I would say, second issue. And all of this, to me, points to an increased importance of the forces that we have as NATO deployed in Europe, both in terms of them being one of the options of responding to Russian nuclear attack and a measure of signaling, right? Because NATO has discussions about its nuclear posture. It's jointly managed somehow, to some extent, by NATO. We have joint exercises, planning, and so on. And I think although NATO is improving its nuclear deterrent, we are a little bit more open about it, about our new exercises. We are modernizing it. You know, countries in Europe, this handful of countries which participate in nuclear sharing, are buying new fighters, F-35s, which would be stealthy and, you know, that's more effective at carrying those bombs if necessary than the older aircraft right now. US is modernizing bombs which are deployed in Europe. But then again, there are things, definitely things that could be done and should be done to make this posture in Europe more survivable against a potential Russian attack, and definitely things that could be done to signal our resolve to Russians that we will not be intimidated now or in the future by Russian nuclear threats.
Before we get to the current NATO nuclear posture and what should be changed in your assessment as we're looking at the NATO summit and what chances you give of things changing in the context of the NATO summit coming up, I want to also ask you about NATO's nuclear posture before 2022. You talk about it in the report, but I think it's useful to draw it out here a little bit for our audience in terms of what has happened in Europe among policymakers in relation to the United States, but also public opinion that hasn't been too friendly due to Cold War experiences, hasn't been too friendly to NATO nuclear postures generally on the continent, and also Obama's time and how we adapted after 2014. And in this context, it's worth remembering that Obama got the Nobel Prize for Peace for a nuclear-free world. And so with that in mind, can you contextualize the 2010s? What is happening with the NATO nuclear posture and transatlantic relations in this context before 2014 and then after 2014?
Yes, that's a great question. Well, basically, after 2014, NATO is sort of relearning nuclear deterrence and trying to really conduct a specific nuclear deterrence of Russia. Because, as you already alluded to, before 2014, for many years, nuclear weapons have been marginalized in NATO, and they have been mostly discussed in terms of arms control. So, very quick, very briefly, during the Cold War, nuclear weapons were at the center of defense and deterrence posture of North Atlantic Alliance, not just as means of responding to a potential Soviet nuclear attack, but also, you know, they were supposed to counterbalance this advantage that the Soviets had in conventional forces. So basically, NATO was planning to nuke, you know, Soviet invasion force if they broke through Western defenses. And, you know, the role of nuclear weapons there was absolutely central. But then after Cold War ended, first of all, most of the nuclear weapons that US has been deploying in Europe has been reduced from over 7,000 at the peak of Cold War, 7,000 warheads, to probably around 100 warheads today. And then for many years, many leaders, especially in Europe, I've been thinking about nuclear weapons as some kind of, you know, thing of the past. And in 2010, which you mentioned, well, there was the US, which was talking about nuclear-free world and all of that. But actually, there were even more pro-disarmament voices in Europe. It was the German government in 2010, which was actually calling for withdrawal of these remaining weapons from Europe. And here I should add that Germany is one of the countries which hosts nuclear weapons in Europe, which allegedly, I mean, everyone knows that's the case, but NATO doesn't say it openly. It's Germany, Belgium, Italy, Netherlands, and Turkey. So you could have seen it, for example, also in terms of, you know, if you look at strategic documents from 2010 and 2012, the parts about nuclear weapons have been very slimmed down and nuclear deterrence compared to what we had like in 1990s, for example, not to mention Cold War. And, you know, after Crimea happened, after Russia annexed Crimea and invaded Ukraine for the first time, and they did it also with some nuclear signaling and nuclear threats, although not as blatant and as often as during this recent full-scale invasion, NATO slowly started to adapt. So first, we have this modernization that I mentioned. Before 2014, it wasn't certain whether, you know, Germany and other countries participating in nuclear training would buy the next generation of aircraft to carry those bombs. Even after 2014, it was a contentious issue, especially in Germany. But it is happening right now. So this is one thing. And we are talking in NATO amongst ourselves, amongst the allies, but also publicly more about nuclear deterrence. Again, you can see it in NATO communiques, in NATO Secretary General speaking on the issue. But then again, things are happening, definitely. So we should appreciate it. But then again, the main difference, I would say, is that Russians are first and foremost much more open in talking about nuclear weapons, not just as a deterrent, but they are openly threatening with them, which is one thing. And the other thing is that NATO has been self-restrained. So we are basically modernizing what we have. We are not deploying, you know, new additional bombs or additional types of nuclear delivery systems such as missiles to Europe. And Russians have been doing exactly that. They've been doing more. They have been continuously deploying new types of missiles targeting Europe, for example, in violation of the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. You know, NATO has not been moving its nuclear weapons east. Russia has been declaring, and Belarus has been declaring since last year, that Russian nuclear weapons are now deployed in Belarus. So there is a mismatch there. And the thing that you mentioned is a very important one, because in many Western European countries, there are these memories of Cold War, massive Cold War protests against nuclear weapons. And nuclear weapons are unpopular in many of those countries, especially the ones that host them, which is one of the reasons why Central Allies are very cautious about doing, you know, more than we are doing as regards nuclear deterrence, deploying additional things and stuff like that. The other one is that some allies are still concerned about moves that, in their opinion, would provoke Russia. And, you know, I can argue with that argument all day. Maybe I'll do it in a second. But just to give the context, for many allies, deploying nuclear weapons in the eastern flank closer to Russia would be seen as something escalatory and provocative to Russia. Although I don't know what, first of all, Russia is doing things, you know, unprovoked. And on the other hand, I really can't imagine what else would they do, how it could be worse. So yes, some concerns about provoking Russia and concerns about public reaction in NATO countries are the things which are limiting what we are doing, right? And what countries are willing to do in NATO. Although, to just end this part, in 2022 and 2023, there have been some surveys made in Germany and Netherlands, I believe, which noted an increase in support for hosting nuclear weapons. So a couple of years back, two-thirds of Germans, or even more, supportive of withdrawing US nuclear weapons from Germany. According to this 2023 poll, more than 50% are now in favor of keeping them in Germany. So it's not the first time that Putin, with his actions, is actually helping NATO make the right decisions and change public opinion in NATO countries.
I'd like to draw you out on what's different about the current situation from the late Cold War, and two things in particular. I'm struck by, as an old person who lived through the late Cold War, first of all, remembering the discussion about the deployment of Pershings to Germany and elsewhere in Europe at the time, we could tell ourselves that the most likely targets for those weapons would be, as you said, invading Soviet forces. So the bombs would fall, so to speak, on the former captive nations of the Warsaw Pact, not necessarily in Russia proper, at least at the start. Now, because of the fact that Eastern European and Central European countries are no longer under that yoke, the likelihood of striking Russian territory is almost inevitable. I mean, we see this to a certain degree even in the exchanges in the recent strikes on Kharkiv, where we're sort of preventing or begging the Ukrainians not to attack the launch sites just over the border near Belgorod and elsewhere in Russia. So the proximity Russia proper to the front line strips away a sort of level of ambiguity about the use of nuclear weapons that I think we can see already has people on edge. A second thing that strikes me too, and again, recalling the Pershing deployment controversies, if there was a move to redeploy U.S. weapons, say, to Poland, you have to ask yourself whether that would be a relief to the Germans or introduce new anxieties into German thinking, or possibly both. So as you sort of look at both sides of the equation, it really looks like it might be quite different from what it was in the late 1980s. And I'd be interested in your thoughts about, again, sort of what would be different rather than the same, and whether this requires not so much to relearn the Cold War lessons, but to come up with some new thinking about what this, you know, nuclear balance would actually be like.
Sure, this is another great question. So in some aspects, the situation, right, is more complicated to NATO. In at least one aspect, is better. It's better in the sense that today, you know, NATO is planning to have its defense against conventional invasion conventional, right? NATO nations are committed to build up their conventional forces, and they are investing more in them. Many of them should be doing more in that respect, but generally the plan is to meet a potential Russian conventional attack with conventional defense. And we have the capacity to do that. We just need capability, right? So if we manage to do that, NATO would not have to face this dilemma that it faced through the Cold War or most of the Cold War of using nuclear weapons early. And to be clear, my recommendation about increasing NATO's nuclear forces in Europe and deploying some of them east is not about threatening to nuke Russian conventional forces potentially attacking the Baltics or Poland. We should be able to defend them without nukes. My recommendations are about signaling towards Russia and improving our options of response to a potential Russian nuclear attack in Europe. And here, again, a very important issue that you touched upon. Indeed, the changing geopolitical situation and participation in NATO, who is in NATO and, you know, who is allied in Russia, although I just use quotation marks because obviously, you know, Warsaw Pact countries weren't allies of Russia, they were just dominated by Russia. It makes this escalation management and potential, you know, thinking about how to respond to limited Russian attack more difficult. So there are definitely additional escalation risks related to the fact if you were to use a nuclear weapon, then most likely NATO would have to strike Russian territory early. Although, as you mentioned, Pershings, indeed, most of NATO's nuclear weapons during Cold War deployed in Europe were so-called tactical ones, meant for use on the battlefield. But the Pershings, Glickens, which were deployed in Germany and other Western European countries in the 80s, they had a medium range. They could have reached Soviet Union. Even more, one of the arguments of proponents of deploying those missiles, and you know, the main proponent of that was Germany, was that we need to have nuclear weapons which launched from Europe can reach Soviet territory to send this message that, you know, even if Russia and US have this mutual destruction situation in which they can basically, if one of them strikes the other with long-range nuclear forces, the other can still return that strike and destroy the other, then even despite that, the US and NATO is willing to selectively but attack even Soviet territory in some kind of limited fashion, if it's necessary to stop the aggression. So this capability was needed then, it is needed now, and I'm not making an argument to redeploy nuclear weapons from Germany or any other Western European country to Poland or Eastern Flank. Actually, it would be the best situation if we had additional US nuclear weapons deployed in Europe, because then we would have more bases. More bases of these weapons means it's more difficult for Russians to take them out, so it would make the posture more survivable. And apart from having a strong symbolic value to the Russians, having some of these weapons and aircraft that carry them deployed in the east would make them basically easier to use. Because let's remember that these weapons are being carried by fighter aircraft, which have limited range, and most likely if used from Western Europe, they would need, you know, tanker support that would have to be refueled in flight, which NATO is exercising, right? But it makes the operation more complicated. From Poland or some other Eastern Flank country, they could reach Russia without that refueling, without, you know, having to wait for these tankers, which could be destroyed, for example, during wartime and not be available immediately. And it would give also Russian air defense less time to react. So in addition to that symbolic value, I think there is also a military value in enlarging nuclear sharing to the east. And but to add to your point that, you know, Germans and others would be worried about the escalatory effect, I'm saying that this would be having some nuclear weapons deployed in the eastern part of NATO would be of high symbolic value, precisely because it wouldn't be an easy decision for NATO. And if you want to convey your resolve that you are not as sensitive about nuclear weapons and escalations as Russia might think, actually, the more controversial the issue for the Allies, the more weight it would carry.
I would also say it's a good thing to sort of equalize the risk across the alliance, too. I mean, that's hard to quantify, but the prospects for different nations fracturing under that kind of stress seems to be quite high.
No, I just wanted to add, it's a spot-on, I would say, remark in the sense that even NATO, in its communique, says, I'm quoting, you know, the broadest possible participation of Allies in NATO's nuclear burden sharing demonstrates alliance unity and resolve. And then you look at the map and the fact that, you know, the eastern part of the alliance is not in that nuclear hosting or nuclear delivery mission, which doesn't send, in my view, the best sign of unity. Then again, just one very short remark, because I am arguing for, you know, the full extension of nuclear sharing, which means deploying the bombs and having the aircraft of certain countries like Poland certified to carry them. But as you already noted, this would be the more controversial option. The less controversial option, which I think is at least in the let's say, medium term more likely, and some Polish officials also alluded to that last year, would be to just Poland to have its future F-35s, which we are also buying for conventional operations, certify their pilots trained to carry nuclear weapons, which wouldn't be stored on Polish territory, but they would kind of, these F-35s would kind of serve as a reserve in case of, you know, this German or Dutch or other nuclear sharing participants' aircraft, if they were destroyed before they got to use nuclear weapons. Because let's remember, these are called dual-capable aircraft, right? They also conduct conventional operations like, you know, shooting down any enemy aircraft and so on. So in wartime, before they are called up for a nuclear mission, they could be destroyed in some other operations on the ground or in the air by the Russians. So this nuclear sharing light, so to speak, option would not carry as much added value politically and militarily as the full participation, but it would still improve deterrence.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask you two questions that bring us home to today and looking forward to the NATO summit. The first one you already mentioned, but I know you want to talk more about it, and I know we do too, and that is fear of escalation. And correct me if I'm wrong about the scenario that we're all fearful of, and that is that Russia would drop a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine. We even have reports that the United States was readying itself for such a scenario in 2022. And so how come, if this is the more likely scenario, that it seems to me fear is increasing the further you move from the battlefield? As in, Ukrainians don't seem that fearful. They have to take that into account, and they have a fight for survival. I didn't hear major fears neither from Poland nor from Romania or other Eastern flank members, but you have significant fear and significant talk of this fear as driving NATO's nuclear posture overall in places such as here in Washington, D.C., as well as in Berlin and others. So help us make sense of that if you can. And then the second part is, how do we combine this with what you are expecting from and what we should be expecting from the NATO summit? We've had conversations among allies that, based on Russia's adjusted nuclear posture with the deployment of nuclear weapons in Belarus, it would be high time to at least signal some light changes in our posture and in the language that we're using when we're reconfirming that NATO is a nuclear and is supposed to stay a nuclear alliance at the NATO summit, NATO 75. So what are you expecting in light of the predominant fear of escalation, but also in the context of Russia's adjustments from the NATO summit coming up?
So first of all, the possibility of Russia using nuclear weapons in this conflict against Ukraine, it exists, although I would say there is no immediate risk of them doing so. First of all, they don't have a need to do that, even in military terms right now, because as much as they are not getting the territorial gains they want, they are on the offensive right now conventionally, because Ukraine is not getting the help it should be getting from the West in terms of volume and the range of systems being provided. So they have no use for that. And it would be risky also for the Russians themselves in many aspects to use nuclear weapons, even against a non-NATO member like Ukraine. So I assume that they would probably consider this option only if faced with strategic defeat there, some collapse of their armies, or for example, loss of Crimea. And even then, I wouldn't say they would necessarily do that. It would all very much depend on what the West does. And it seems that in the autumn 2022, which you mentioned, US warnings about potential catastrophic consequences of Russia using nuclear weapons in Ukraine, which allegedly, as we hear from the press, included warnings from US, UK and France that if Russia uses a nuclear weapon, there would be conventional strikes from these three NATO countries against Russian forces in Ukraine. It appears that it contributed to deterring Russia from using nuclear weapons when their own front line in Kherson and elsewhere was threatened. So saying that the possibility is there doesn't mean that it would necessarily happen. It also depends on what we do. So the possibility of Russians doing this definitely does not deter us from helping Ukraine. Because as I said in the beginning, if they believe that nuclear coercion, nuclear intimidation worked in this instance, they will do this again. And you might very well have another invasion under this umbrella of nuclear threats, next time maybe against a NATO country. So you just need to do their best to deter the Russians. As regards NATO summit and expectations, I would love the NATO summit in Washington to announce major changes in nuclear sharing and new countries being accepted there, especially my country, Poland. Now, the signs are it's not going to happen. It doesn't seem that this is high on the agenda for NATO summit. There are some signs that some sorts of discussions are taking place within NATO about nuclear posture, but we don't know the details. To me, even saying openly at NATO Washington summit that, yes, we are discussing NATO posture changes, to be very clear about this, that we are discussing, we can do something more than we are doing right now. This would already constitute a signal towards the Russians that, you know, their actions also in nuclear dimension have consequences and there are things that NATO can do. But at the end of the day, as with many other things with NATO and security, obviously the US presidential elections, you know, are the most important thing coming up. So if there are any major moves on NATO's nuclear posture, I would expect them from political standpoint to happen after the election result is known.
Thank you so much, Artur Kacprzyk. We didn't get to my very straightforward and non-controversial proposal for Poland to acquire its own nuclear arsenal as a way of Trump-proofing its own security. But we can leave that subject for some other time. But we'll include a link to my very uncontroversial piece in the show notes.
Yes, thanks. If we have time, I can give you a couple of...
Yeah, go ahead. Come on.
Yeah, as regards Poland and nuclear weapons, of course, you know, it would be the best option to have our own nuclear weapons and, you know, be as independent as possible in defense against the Russians, because it's always more credible that the country which is being attacked and which faces an existential threat would use nuclear weapons than its ally, right? Which can still do that, but, you know, it's difficult. One thing to risk a nuclear war if your territory is not attacked, if you are United States, for example, and you are defending an ally and your important interests, but still not your territory directly. And another thing, if you are attacked and you have no other choice, right? That being said, of course, well, it would be risky for Poland to try to get nuclear weapons right now, because it would worsen our relations with allies. We'd have to either break or withdraw from our non-proliferation commitments, which would get us in a lot of trouble with the United States also, including sanctions, possibly weakening our security guarantees in NATO. And then Russia might be willing to try to exploit that situation to attack us even more so than they might already want to do, right? To prevent us from getting nuclear weapons. So I would say that if the scenario that we discussed at the beginning, if US was to drastically reduce its involvement in the alliance, or maybe its non-proliferation policy, then the question of Poland or other countries getting nuclear weapons would be more, I would say, acute and could be more consideration given to that. At this point, I think the priority is to make NATO and NATO's nuclear deterrent as credible as possible.
Certainly agree with that. You know, the fact that we are having this conversation in a sort of semi-serious tone suggests how difficult and challenging the international situation is and how there are real downside risks the next couple of months, both within the alliance and on its eastern flank. Arthur, thank you so much. From me, Dalibor Rohac.
Me, Giselle Donnelly.
And Julia Zosno.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Front, a podcast dedicated to security challenges that have erupted along the line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, aei.org, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please do get in touch with us on Twitter using the hashtag EasternFrontPod, written as one word. And don't forget to sign up for The Eastern Front's newsletter through the link included in the show notes to receive more content from The Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Thank you, and goodbye.